City, let's go.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
This Thursday, August 17th at 10 p.m., join your host, Baby K, on The Sweet Spot as we present Words on Music from some of our favorite artists. You'll hear new interviews with the Foreign Exchange and jazz artist Carmen Lundy, along with some of our fave excerpts from past shows, including disco pioneer Patrick Adams, Alpha Anderson, former lead singer of Chic, Roy Ayers, Brian Jackson, photographer Jameel Shabazz, and legendary Afrobeat artist Femi Kuti. That's The Sweet Spot, August 17th at 10 p.m., only on WBAI, listener-sponsored community radio.
Joy of resistance, we're sisters of the joy of resistance.
Joy of Resistance, multicultural feminist radio at WBAI, is now airing every Sunday at 6 to 7 p.m. Join us as we cover the ongoing and worldwide struggle of women for full equality and human rights that is being waged in one form or another in every country and culture on the planet. We'll keep you up to date on this very active area with great guests and discussion. We'll show how today's events often have their roots in what has come before. We'll feature music and culture of the struggle. And we'll invite you to participate in new segments such as What's on Your Feminist Mind? So tune in on Sundays between 6 and 7 p.m. for an in-depth look at issues that affect half the world. And the other half, too.
Government, religion, husband, father, brother, gonna define our existence. Joy.
Welcome to Health Action on listener-supported community radio WBAI in New York. I'm Mark Hannay, Director of Metro New York Healthcare for All, and a member of the Health Action program that brings Health Action Collective that brings you this program every week. In this week's program, we've got two interesting segments. First up, we're going to be taking a look at what the heck has been going on in Congress and particularly the Senate on healthcare in the last few weeks, catching up on things and looking forward to what's coming when they all come back after Labor Day. And in the second half, we have a very special interview taking a look at the history of healthcare in New York State over the last half decade since the beginning of the Medicare and Medicaid programs. But first, we'll start out with our Health Action news for this week, taken from stories posted to Kaiser Health News. Just move on. That's what most people say Congress and the Trump administration should do after the Senate failed to approve legislation in late July to revamp the Affordable Care Act, according to a survey released last week. Nearly 8 in 10 Americans say President Trump should be trying to make the health law work, according to a poll conducted by the Kaiser Family Foundation. This includes large majorities of Democrats, about 95%, as well as half of Republicans, 52%, and even President Trump's hardcore supporters at 51%. Almost 6 in 10 people think that the Republicans should work with Democrats to improve the health law. Only 17% of the public and 40% of Republicans think the Trump administration should take steps to make the health law fail. President Trump has threatened to end funding to insurers to cover cost-sharing subsidies that cover out-of-pocket health expenses for millions of low-income people buying coverage on new health exchanges. Insurers say such a move would force them to leave the health law marketplaces or to raise premiums quite significantly. Nearly two-thirds of the public oppose the president's negotiating tactics, the survey said. Just 21% of respondents, but 49% of Republicans, want Congress and the administration to continue working on a plan to repeal and replace the health care law. About 60% of people say that Trump and the congressional Republicans are responsible for any problems with the law now that they're in charge. Trump has claimed that the public will blame Democrats for any problem. The health law is more popular than ever, with 52% of respondents saying they hold a favorable view of it. This has been a 9 percentage point increase in people who favor the law since the November elections. Political reports that President Donald Trump has said he's drafting paperwork to declare the opioid crisis a national emergency, just days after administration officials downplayed the need for such a declaration. Trump made the surprise announcement late last week at his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey. Trump was briefed on the epidemic earlier in the week by HHS Secretary Dr. Tom Price, who told reporters at the time that the administration believed the crisis could be effectively addressed without declaring an emergency. Trump vowed then that his administration would beat the epidemic by beefing up law enforcement and strengthening security on the southern border to stop illegal drugs from entering the country. An emergency declaration was first recommended last week by the White House's Commission on Combating Drug Addiction and the Opioid Crisis, led by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. It enables the federal government to quickly free up funds to respond to the epidemic. It also allows Trump to say he's fulfilling a promise to combat opioid misuse that he made as a presidential candidate. Trump handily won states like West Virginia and Kentucky that have been the hardest hit of the epidemic. The president's announcement comes just as new federal data shows that drug overdose deaths are on the rise, despite federal and state efforts to curb the crisis. In the first 9 months of 2016, the National Center for Health Statistics estimates drug overdose deaths hit a record 19.9 per 100,000 people, up from 16.7 people for the same time period a year earlier. Trump's Opioid Commission also recommended loosening certain Medicaid restrictions to increase access to inpatient substance abuse treatment and helping states strengthen prescription drug monitoring programs intended to weed out doctor shopping and improper prescribing. It's unclear if Trump plans to accept those recommendations. The president's rhetoric on the opioid epidemic has largely focused on a law and order approach. He's not yet addressed increased access to treatment programs that public health experts say are necessary to get the epidemic under control. State public health officials have also expressed concerns about the president's emphasis on law enforcement. Even law enforcement officials have told the president to focus not just on the criminal justice aspect of addressing the crisis, but to a more supportive, comprehensive strategy involving public health and education departments as well. And finally, research shows that obesity and depression are intertwined, yet scientists don't know why. However, that sense of disconnect has started to change, promising new avenues for treatment, but also presenting a new puzzle: how to chart the mechanics of what ties the two issues together, and how treatment can be linked for the two disorders that are usually dealt with separately in totally different parts of the healthcare system. Both conditions are on the rise, heightening the need to unlock the connection and develop treatments that address both conditions simultaneously. The relationship between obesity and depression is what researchers call bidirectional, meaning that being obese or overweight ups the odds of depression and vice versa. While on the surface the two conditions can appear very different, they share important similarities. Both are chronic diseases that are tricky to treat, requiring long-term physical and mental health interventions. In cases in which depression and obesity coincide, those interventions can be even more complex, with research often showing that the best results occur when care involves not only doctors and nurses, but also other health professionals. While the Affordable Care Act promoted coordinated care as part of its efforts to lower cost, those initiatives haven't been directed toward depression and obesity taken together. Depression and obesity are among the largest drivers of health care cost increases. Obesity already costs the medical system $150 billion a year in direct costs, and depression makes that price tag worse. major depressive disorder across the country costs more than $200 billion a year in direct costs, such as psychiatric visits, medication, and other treatments, as well as hours and days in which afflicted people aren't able to work. The federal government has worked to expand mental health access and insurance coverage, but in many parts of the country, few mental health specialists actually accept insurance. There's also the added challenge of finding a physician able to address both problems at once. Research suggests primary care physicians who are on the front lines in providing care aren't meeting clinical standards for treating depression. And that's the Health Action News for this week. We'll be back with our first segment, taking a look at what's been going on in Congress in recent weeks around health care, the Affordable Care Act, and Medicaid. Stay tuned. Welcome to Health Action. I'm Mark Hanna. In our first interview segment today, we're going to be kind of playing catch up on what's been going on in Congress around health care since we've last covered it on the program. With the fundraiser happening last month, we kind of were on hiatus for a little bit, and there was a lot of dramatic action. Joining us is Margarita George, co-executive director with Healthcare for America Now, the national campaign out in the states that's building grassroots power on this issue. And Mary Clark, Southern Tier Regional Director with Citizen Action of New York, that is leading the Healthcare for America Now campaign here in New York State. Welcome back to Health Action, Margarita and Mary.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. So last time we spoke with both of you, I think, was actually just before the House voted on the bill. So let's go way back to then. That was early May. And we were not expecting a House vote at that point in time. We thought the bill was kind of dead. So, Margarita, how and why did it come back to life? And then it moved on to the Senate.
Well, I mean, through a series of I think about as pretty desperate negotiations, I mean, really what happened to bring that bill back into play is Fred Upton from Michigan, who's a longtime opponent of the Affordable Care Act, but a well-respected member in the Republican Party who has often led anti-ACA efforts in the past, stepped up after saying just a few days before that the AHCA, the Republican bill, was unacceptable. He stepped up to co-author an amendment with a freshman senator from Missouri, Billy Long, around pre-existing conditions, which had been a sticking point for a lot of the members. And so that amendment eventually got, that in combination with the MacArthur Amendment, which we might have talked about last time, got enough Republicans to vote for the bill. But the whole process was really this process because there's so much division among the Republicans about what they want to see in a repeal and replace. The whole process was really very piecemeal, sort of backroom negotiations, wheeling and dealing to see what they could put in here that would get just enough people to support the bill.
And to get it over to the Senate side. So then the Senate picks it up, and what starts to happen there?
Well, initially, everybody, the AHCA passed. There was a moment of victory, but the Senate initially said that the bill was so terrible and so unpopular that they wouldn't take it up. And so the Senate really began the process from where the House left off, announcing that they would craft their own bill. And there was a period in which they were coming up with a number of proposals. Ultimately, the proposals that they came up with were very, very similar to what was in the House Republican bill. All proposals that really wouldn't do much to help people get better health care, to keep people covered. Various different versions of the bill emerged. They all ultimately failed. Repeal, repeal only, skinny repeal. Every single version of the bill, based on a CBO analysis, would have dropped tens of millions of people off of coverage, would have increased premiums by as much as 20%, watered down basic protections. And all but one of the bills would have dramatically restructured Medicaid, and not just the Medicaid expansion, which we know a lot of folks got coverage under the Affordable Care Act. because of the expansion of the public program Medicaid. But the Republican proposals weren't just proposing to roll back that expansion. They wanted a fundamental restructuring of the entire program, the 52-year-old program that's been providing care to seniors and people with disabilities and children for many years. And so, you know, we saw this whole process play out, lots of, you know, like in the House, very secretive, very difficult to tell what was going on. A number of different proposals came out. They brought it to the floor, and ultimately they were unable to secure enough votes in the last minute to be able to pass their bill.
So, Mary, while that was going on in Washington, what was going on here in New York?
Well, in New York, I think we were on the streets in front of congressional offices almost weekly. With every new proposal that they put out, we were there with people who would be directly affected by lose their coverage, would be directly affected by their proposals, which meant, you know, a million New Yorkers dropped, almost 2 million total with the essential health plan being dropped, people being dropped from the Medicaid expansion, hospitals. We had hospital administrators speaking out, talking about how devastating it would be to our hospitals. We're up in a rural area. Rural hospitals would be destroyed. You know, it was just going to be devastation all around. And I think they heard week after week in front of congressional offices that this is going to hurt New Yorkers. And I think, you know, despite, you know, all their efforts, we were able to prevail. People's voices united on the streets, on the phones, emails, you name it. Everyone was really engaged in this, from doctors, hospitals, people on the streets, people who are directly affected, the disability community, all sorts of people were out there saying how this is going to affect us.
And Margarita, in your arena in Washington, D.C., it sort of seemed like within the final couple weeks or so of the Senate debate process, the halls of the Senate office buildings were literally invaded by hundreds of people that were really up in their faces.
Yeah, absolutely. And it wasn't, I just can't emphasize enough how important it was, particularly to have people with disabilities occupying offices, right? The message that they sent in their wheelchairs, with their canes, just coming to Washington from all over the country, seniors, clergy, so quite a variety of people really saying, you know, that this process has been a totally behind closed door process. You haven't engaged constituents. And of course, people's anger was really boiling over in many, many places. This might have been true in some of the work that Mary did in New York, too. Folks have been trying to contact their elected leaders for months to get answers about these repeal proposals. And in many cases, members of Congress and members of the Senate have been unwilling to even talk to their constituents. And what has happened, and Senator John McCain, who ultimately cast the most important bill to kill the last repeal proposal, made this case as the rationale for why he had to vote against the bill, that not only was the bill horrible and did it hurt his constituents in Arizona and constituents around the country, but the process by which these bills and these proposals were being negotiated really put in jeopardy the very process of democracy. When legislators can sit behind a closed door and secretly negotiate a bill that is going to take health care away from millions of people, raise millions of more people's costs, at the same time give billions away in tax cuts to the rich, and that folks don't even have an opportunity in district, that they have to come up to Washington, D.C. and literally sit in Mitch McConnell's office in order to be able to get some basic answers or to get a reaction from lawmakers. Really incredible testimony to grassroots organizing and the power of people to shape the legislative process.
Now, Mary, here in New York, as the Senate debate was going on, we had two Democratic senators, so we didn't have quite as heavy a lift, if you will, as perhaps activists in other states.
what role did, well, obviously Senator Schumer is a key person. He's head of the Democrats in the Senate. But what role did our two senators play?
Well, I think they really showed leadership. They stood up and they were opposed to the hold repeal motion movement. They really, you know, really stood up and really worked very hard to try to stop and raise the voices. I think our governor really played a pivotal role too, really putting out document after document of how many millions of New Yorkers would be affected, how much each of our hospitals would be affected. They were really showing district by district how we would lose as New York.
And Margarita, our Governor Cuomo wasn't the only governor weighing in on this process, right?
That's right. And governors were really important in this process. And governors like Governor Sandoval in Nevada that really helped Senator Heller for a long time raise concerns and really delay this process, giving us more opportunity to organize. Governor Ducey in Arizona was really critically important, and you'll see a lot of quotes from Senator John McCain and Senator Flake that said, I have to do what is best for my state, and the governor of my state says these changes would devastate our state. So governors have been really critical, state legislators, and I might add mayors, and certainly Mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, has been a great champion, really not only in New York City, but also organizing colleague mayors in other cities to speak out about the local impact in some of these large cosmopolitan areas.
We'll turn in a moment to what's coming up next, but it seems to me that the failure of this effort to outright repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act per se was a major political moment. What was the reaction sort of inside the Beltway, Margarita, when this happened?
We're not used to surprises up here in Washington, D.C. It's pretty, in past years, there's been a lot of ho-hum. I think there was genuine surprise, really genuine shock across the board on the part of Democrats and Republicans that not just one bill was beaten back, but several different bills were beaten back. And I think the impact is really incredibly important. And it's incredibly important because the fact that the Republican Party, President Trump, Republican leaders in Congress, despite the fact that they really control the whole federal government, they control the presidency, they control the House, they control the Senate, they control every government agency, including the ones that enforce the Affordable Care Act, have been unable to move their agenda, has weakened them on every other issue. Because they've been unable to move their agenda on health care, they've also been unable to move their agenda on tax breaks for the rich, which is really the central thread that runs between all of their policy proposals. And when you think about in most administrations where you have a new president, the vast majority of the new policy happens in the first year of that administration. Here we are three quarters of the year through the first year of President Trump's administration, and in fact, they have almost nothing to show for being in office. They have not been able to demonstrate an ability to govern or to pass any type of comprehensive legislation, and it's largely exposed how divided they are amongst themselves and the fact that they really don't have the muscle after all of these years of obstructing progress to actually work toward advancing anything. And so here we are on the brink of very short time left in the legislative session. They have big goals, but there's not a lot of confidence here on the part of the press and on a part of many of the members within the administration or Congress that they're actually going to be able to move anything.
So, Mary, we've got a little bit of a lull here in the action. Congress is out on recess now. Their effort around the ACA per se has stalled out, shall we say. But there's no rest for the weary. What have activists in New York have been up to so far this month?
Well, Well, we've had lots of, we've been out on the streets talking about the cost-sharing reduction payments, which Donald Trump, in retaliation to losing the health care repeal vote, has talked about not making those payments. And they're payments that keep our insurance rates low. Our insurance rates will go up 20% if he doesn't make these payments. We've been really pushing, and also our essential benefit program, our program here in New York, 700,000 people would lose their coverage. So we've been out on the street saying, you've got to make these payments, and we're calling on our Congress people to urge Donald Trump to make these payments and for Congress to take over making these payments. And even Congressman Reed and Faso have been out saying we need to do this kind of thing. So that's one thing. But we've also been telling our Congress people, they just had a big 65 birthday party for Congressman Faso down in the Kingston area, basically raising the point that now you're 65, you're on Medicare. Don't hurt our Medicare. Don't hurt our Social Security. And don't take away our Medicaid. I think we're really concerned, and there's actions being planned all over the state on Long Island, up in the North Country, here in Claudia Tenney's district, just to tell our Congress people how upset we are about their vote and that they have a next chance to turn their failing grade, so to speak, in their new semester when they go back to work, to keep their hands off our Medicaid, to keep their hands off our health care, because they're proposing a lot of really dangerous things in the upcoming budget, which will devastate, will take, you know, over $1 trillion away from Medicaid. So they keep trying to do these things all to benefit the very rich, you know, giving them tax breaks. So we have to say, don't touch our health care. They have proposals about voucherizing Medicare. They have tons of different proposals that they're going to eke at us or throw at us in terms of trying to hurt the health care protection we now have. And I think we need to be prepared to really fight these cuts back as well. It's not the big old ACA, but it's a thousand cuts, you know, that will have the same effect on people losing their vital health care program.
Margarita, you mentioned that there are some big things that are coming up for Congress. What are they facing when they come back after Labor Day?
Well, they're going to be really busy. There's a set of statutory deadlines that they're going to need to address. And then, as Mary's saying, there's the 2018 budget resolution. And she's absolutely right. I mean, they're even though they lost the fight on their many repeal bills, they're not going to give up on repealing the Affordable Care Act, and they're certainly not going to give up, because they haven't for 50 years, on dismantling Medicaid and Medicare. And so they're going to be working on a huge budget resolution that's already moving through the House. Paul Ryan, the Speaker, says there'll be a vote on that resolution in September. On the Senate side, Senator Enzi is going to take the lead in drafting the Senate version of the FY 2018 budget. And I'll just say on that budget, the budget includes immediate adoption of the AHCA, which is the House-passed bill we were talking about earlier. And so they have no intention of giving up on repeal. In fact, they're including the repeal bill in their legislation. And it doesn't stop there. In addition to that bill, which would cut $800 billion out of healthcare and Medicaid, they want a total of $1.5 trillion cut out of health programs. And so that budget resolution is going to be debated in September, and there'll be a lot of attention on it. Also in September, we're going to see the expiration of funding for the CHIP program, the Children's Health Insurance Program, which operates side-by-side with Medicaid and provides health care to the lowest-income kids. That's going to be a major political battle, as well as the continuing resolution, which is the resolution that funds government. And we may be headed for a government shutdown because of failure to renew funding in the continuing resolution, as well as the debate coming up about the debt ceiling. So there will be a confluence of different things coming up, and it will really ratchet up pressure on the Republicans to figure out what they're going to do to keep the government running and not default on debt, while at the same time advancing a budget for the first time in, you know, quite a few years.
And Mary, how are the activist community here in New York? How are we getting ready for all that?
Well, like I said, there's a lot of things going on. I think we're going to have a bunch of back to school events where people are going to be talking about how the Medicaid cuts will affect programs that are funded through Medicaid for special needs children in our schools. We're also going to be standing up about the possibility of losing our Child Health Plus funding, plus education funding, which they also have included in the budget to be cut. So we'll be doing events in regard to that with our education partners. One thing that is happening for you folks in New York City to be aware of, there's a new tour, a bus tour around the country that is coming into New York, and it's a nationwide Drive for Our Lives bus tour that's focusing on all the proposed cuts to health care in the budget and saying to us, making us aware. And that's coming to New York City on September 2nd. I don't have the particular logistics yet. They're working them out. But I just think your New York City viewers should be aware of that the national tour is coming into New York. I think there'll be a number of town halls happening in September around the budget and budget forums to educate people on the proposals that are out there. And then, Margarita, we have the big National Day of Action on August 30th. Happening all around the country to raise attention to for them, with them going back to work, that they need to keep their hands off our health care.
Right. You want to say quickly a couple things about that, Margarita, as we wrap up?
Yeah. It's hard to say it better than that, but yes. So one thing that we're worried about is for regular folks just watching what's been happening on the evening news, and they've seen, you know, that these repeal bills have gone down in flames. A lot of folks might not realize that that is not the end of the Republican efforts to take away health care. And so we are organizing HCAM partners around the country a day of action on August 30th, a few days before the members come back up here to D.C. to resume their work in Congress, to make sure people understand that the Republicans are going to continue trying to cut health care, and it's going to take a lot of different forms. Mary mentioned a number of them: the Trump administration sabotage of the CSR payments, the refusal to implement the Affordable Care Act. In every vehicle that we're going to see, whether it's the federal budget or its infrastructure or its taxes, we are going to see proposed cuts, big, big cuts to Medicaid and Medicare. And I think it's important for people to understand that the central agenda of the Trump administration really is tax breaks for the rich. There's very few places that the Republicans will find enough money to pay for those huge tax cuts for the rich, except for health care. And so we can expect that to be on the chopping block. And our goal on the 30th is to make sure people are alerted to that and that people stay mobilized for the next phase of the fight.
Great. Well, we've been doing a bit of a catch-up here and looking forward to the coming fall session of the Congress and what it means for health care. Our guests have been Margarita George, Co-Executive Director for Healthcare for America Now, and Mary Clark, Southern Tier Regional Director with Citizen Action of New York, who coordinates the Healthcare for America Now campaign across New York State. Thanks so much for coming back and joining us on Health Action, Margarita and Mary.
Thanks, Mark, so much for having us, Mark.
And we'll be back with our second segment in a moment, having a conversation about the history of healthcare in New York State since the beginning of Medicare and Medicaid. Stay tuned. Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In our segment of this part of the program, we're going to be taking a look at the history of healthcare in New York State from the beginning of the period when Medicare and Medicaid came into being. We're going to be talking with Jim Tallon, who's now the former president and CEO of the United Hospital Fund, just retiring from that position, a former state legislature member of the Assembly, and has a long career in health policy. Welcome to Health Action, Jim.
Mark, it's a pleasure to be with you.
And it's an honor to have you on the show. Thank you so much for taking time to do this. So let's start sort of at the very beginning. Before Medicaid and Medicare came along some 50-plus years ago and really started to transform health care in New York State, what was the situation like at that point?
Well, it was the state was actively involved with a series of programs that were aimed at the poor. And, of course, there was a federal support, too, for care for the elderly in a combined state-federal program. The health insurance, private sector health insurance, had taken hold in the market, of course, started in World War II, but did not reach the peak of coverage that it did later, for example, near 1980. So I think what we could say is we had an active state that did a number of things, had a major presence in mental health care, for example, with large state psychiatric centers, and had targeted programs aimed at the poor. But prior to Medicare, not these big federal health insurance was something that people would get often through an employer. That was a growing phenomenon. But there were large numbers of people who didn't have health insurance, and our hospitals and healthcare system relied substantially on philanthropy fundraising activity.
So then Medicare and Medicaid come along in 1965. Medicare is perhaps the most well-known program, but it is primarily a federal program. How did that, or how has that over the years sort of impacted New York?
Well, it is the it's a program that initially, as it was being phased in, New York had higher expenditures under the Medicare program than in other states. We, on a per-day basis or even on with length of stay, with more complicated cases where the healthcare system did more for people. So the healthcare system in New York was rewarded fairly substantially by the Medicare program. It of course, grew. It was initially intended for the elderly. Later in the 70s, it was expanded to aid the disabled. It's a very different Medicare program today than it was back in the beginning. But, of course, it was a huge victory when President Johnson signed it into law.
So then let's turn to Medicaid, which is a much more important program for the state because it's a program that is jointly operated by the states and federal government. What was New York has a long history of supporting and taking full advantage of the Medicaid program. In fact, the common joke that many of us say is that we in New York turned Medicaid from a noun into a verb. But initially, how did Medicaid come into our healthcare system here in New York?
Well, Medicaid was passed as Title 19 of the Social Security Act, the companion to Title 18. Medicare, which, as you indicate, got far more attention. It basically was added to the law as a way of either caring for the indigent in a combined state-federal program, or, if one takes another interpretation, there were those who, telling the history of this period, said that it was really a concession to the opponents to Medicare to demonstrate that we would have a state-federal program aimed at the indigent so that Medicare would not become a universal insurance program for all Americans or socialized medicine as it was known in those days. In New York's perspective, though, Governor Rockefeller, and this 1966, when New York finally got around the next year after federal passage to adopting the law, Governor Rockefeller saw this as an opportunity to draw federal support, 50% of what New York would spend on eligible programs, to draw federal support for many individual targeted programs that we were already running in New York. Nelson Rockefeller saw Medicaid as revenue. I often point out that a little later in the decade, his counterpart in the Republican Party, Ronald Reagan, in California saw Medicaid as a cost being imposed on his state. And for many years, the two states moved with quite different Medicaid programs, influenced by Rockefeller's goal of bringing federal resources to New York, which has really guided the program right through all 50 years since its inception. And the left coast, California, saw it for many, many years as a cost being imposed on the state. Now California uses Medicaid quite aggressively to serve its citizens. The two programs have come to look a lot more similar.
Now, Medicaid sort of has evolved nationally since then. What have been some of the changes or expansions that have happened, and how has New York taken advantage of those?
Well, the important thing is it's had its ups and downs over the years. One will recall that in the Clinton administration, there was a substantial effort by Newt Gingrich, the Republican majority in the House of Representatives that took over in the 94 election, to turn Medicaid into a block grant to cut down on federal Medicaid expenditures. President Clinton vetoed that approach. And Medicaid has continued to grow. I always remind people that Medicaid is essentially four programs in one. It is a program that provides health insurance or health payment or health services to poor people, to low-income folks. It is also a principal source of payment for persons with physical and behavioral disabilities. It provides big coverage in intellectual persons with developmental disabilities, intellectual disabilities, and mental health coverage. It thirdly provides a supplement to the Medicare program. It provides for cost sharing. Medicare, as you know, has premiums associated with it, and Medicaid comes in and pays for those premiums for low-income elderly people. And most importantly, for Medicare beneficiaries, it provides a long-term care benefit that is not in the Medicare program. So by and large, the large portion of our nursing home coverage for the elderly or the disabled is paid for through the Medicaid program. And finally, it acts as a direct source of payment to the safety net of healthcare providers who provide services to low-income or otherwise uninsured people. So that is a sort of an overview of the four elements of Medicaid that really make up the modern program.
And how has that played out in New York over the years?
Well, it has become a program now that covers 6.3 million New Yorkers, almost a third of the state's population. It is now a program at roughly $63 billion in total expenditures. Nationally, it is by far our largest health insurance program. It covers, along with CHIP, the Child Health Insurance Program, about 74 million people now. That's far more than covered under Medicare, and has really grown, as we've seen, to be the workhorse of the system. It does the things that private insurance or that Medicare don't want to take on. Medicaid has become that safety net, that workhorse that fills in the gaps of taking on the tough problems, and that's why it has become so important in the financing of healthcare in New York, but in many other states in the nation.
Now, New York in the 90s, as other states, started to transform its Medicaid, if I can use that program, if I can use that term, from one which was straight payment to providers to where we moved to a system of managed care. Describe what happened then. That was under
I was in the legislature. I was in the legislature until the 93. I served through the 93 session. So I was part of those early days of that transformation. What happened simply, we had an all-payer rate-setting system in New York in which the state was responsible initially in the early 80s for setting all payment rates to hospitals in the state, including Medicare. Medicare ended after a couple of years. But commercial insurance, Blue Cross, Medicaid were all covered under a state rate-setting system. And the managed care providers argued in the private insurance market in the late 80s that they ought to be exempted and allowed to negotiate because they argued that they were more efficient users of service, and that ultimately that authority was granted them by the legislature. So when we got to the early 90s, the commercial insurance market had gone through a significant shift to managed care, and Medicaid, in effect, was catching up with what was occurring or what had occurred in the private insurance market. And to some extent, that compromise in 1991 was critical at a time. This has always had bipartisan support in New York, but I recall very well the spring of 1991 in which Republican leadership in the state Senate said, our support for Medicaid is starting to erode at the grassroots level. The private sector is all moving to managed care. You're still maintaining an individual fee-for-service program in Medicaid, and the shift to managed care for Medicaid, which was done on a pilot basis or a voluntary basis in a 91 law, was eventually made permanent when Governor Pataki, permanent and universal when Governor Pataki took office, I believe in 1996. It was, in effect, Medicaid catching up with the commercial insurance market.
So then we kind of move through another decade or so, and along comes Governor Cuomo, who creates something called the Medicaid Redesign Team. And that's still ongoing in his administration. What's been happening there?
Well, Governor Andrew Cuomo was elected in 2010, and he quickly saw that he had a challenge, a potential deficit in the Medicaid program, and took a very creative approach. He, 2010, recall, was only 2 years after the financial collapse of the country. We were still in 2010 really feeling the economic impact of the Great Recession. And Governor Cuomo essentially said, look, Medicaid is going to cost us more money. I don't have that money in the state treasury at this point, and that was a fairly convincing case. And he reached out broadly to the healthcare industry and created the Medicaid Redesign Team, which essentially said, bring us your ideas about how to change the Medicaid program. It was a participatory process that had been pioneered in Wisconsin by Jason Helgerson, who became our state Medicaid director. And there were those who said, well, how can you possibly bring a participatory process into some place as complex as New York? But the governor and Mr. Helgerson succeeded with the leadership of the healthcare community, and a whole series of changes were made, including reaching agreement to have a standby cap on the growth of expenditures, essentially at a rolling average of the Consumer Price Index, which was considerably lower in cost growth than had been experienced in previous years by the Medicaid program. And that largely has been the program we've been working with since 2011. Along the way, the state was granted a waiver, an 1115, Section 1115 waiver by the federal government to experiment more with the reorganization of services in a process that eventually hopes to change reimbursement to something that is called value-based reimbursement and eliminate the fee-for-service care that previously had been part of most healthcare reimbursement.
Okay, so this is kind of perking along, and then finally in 2010 at the federal level, we get some major comprehensive national health legislation that's been fought for decades. It's known as the Affordable Care Act. What has been the impact of the Affordable Care Act as part of the mix here in New York?
Well, the Affordable Care Act basically looked at low-income persons, low to middle-income working-class people from 100% of the poverty level up to 400% of the poverty level, and created an insurance marketplaces in each of the states where, with subsidized payment, people in those income categories, it was a declining payment. People at 100% of the poverty level got a much higher subsidy than persons at 400%, but were presented with choices to buy individual insurance. And that has largely, in my view, been a success now coming up to the debate that we're currently facing in Washington. But the members of the Congress basically said below 100% of poverty, and it and finally concluded working with 138% of the poverty level, it said we really need to rely on our public program, Medicaid. The private subsidized private insurance isn't going to work. So we're going to authorize, actually in the first law, we're going to require the states increase their Medicaid eligibility up to 138% of the poverty level. That was not a big change in New York. We had already had programs that went as high as 150%. But in many states, the percent of eligibility for the Medicaid program was down at 40 and 50% of the poverty level, much below the poverty level. The Supreme Court came along and said that could not be a mandatory requirement on the states, but it was provided, continued on an optional basis, with the states receiving initially 100% of the increased funding with that expansion available to them from federal sources, declining over the years, but never going below 90%. So the federal government put, and ultimately that complied with the Supreme Court decision, the expansion in Medicaid was viewed really as the base below which the marketplace would and the subsidized marketplace would rest above the Medicaid program. And then, of course, 160 million people or so in the country would continue to get coverage through their employer through private insurance plans.
And so we've had enormous success here in New York with the Affordable Care Act. Our insurance rate is uninsurance rate is now down to less than 5%, according to the State Department of Health. So that's quite an achievement. I neglected to mention another thing that came along in the 90s at the national level, and you mentioned it briefly, was the state child health insurance program. How does that relate to New York's system?
Well, New York had created a children's health insurance program going back into the late 80s. I think it might have been 1990 that the state's first child health insurance program was adopted. This was, of course, before the broader expansions that were built later into a Medicaid program. And New York, I think it was 1996 that finally the federal law, places like Minnesota and New York had been pioneers in indicating that children ought to have coverage. They ought to have coverage up to a higher level of eligibility. There ought to be some increased reimbursement from Washington. And that program is coming up for renewal in Washington at the end of the summer and will be one of the other debates that Washington will be facing when the Congress returns.
Yeah, so let's turn to that and spend a few minutes talking about it. It's been a rather intense 7 months, going now on 8 months, that there has been this conversation, if you will, in the Congress about the future of healthcare in America. What's New York's stake in all of that?
Well, New York's stake in the continuation of the Affordable Care Act is measured in terms of billions of dollars. I think that, remember, the change in the Affordable Care Act, and very important to understand where we are right now, how close the debate of the Congress has come to repealing the Affordable Care Act. There has been universal opposition to that effort by Democrats in both houses. And as we've all seen, the Republican votes ultimately fell short with the Senate's final effort to pass what was called the skinny bill, just to get to a conference with the House of Representatives, and Senator McCain's very dramatic negative vote that with the other with the other two senators who had opposed the bill, Senator Collins, Senator Murkowski, that effort has fallen short now, and we'll see what happens when the Congress goes back. New York's stake estimated in the transition period at about $4 billion, and then costing at least a couple of billion dollars a year going forward, a significant loss of federal subsidy for insurance coverage. But remember, there is a radical provision in the Republican legislation that was in one of the bills that the Senate passed, and that was over time not only to make Medicaid from a program where costs are reimbursed by the federal government into a per capita cap where there is a limit on how much the states would be reimbursed for their Medicaid costs that would no longer take into account the actual costs of caring for people, but would set the artificial, under the one of the Senate bills, ultimately reducing that growth to just the consumer price index. Over the next 10 years, the Congressional Budget Office said the bill advanced, at least one of the bills advanced by the Republicans, would reduce Medicaid reimbursement across the country by $830 billion. And one of the Senate bills that was taken up after 2026, that $830 billion numbers between now and 2026. One of the bills after 2026 would even make deeper cuts in Medicaid reimbursement so that by 2035, there would have been more than a one-third reduction in Medicaid expenditures by the federal government. That is a huge structural change in the relationship between Washington and all of the states, and New York, as a big Medicaid user, would feel that coverage enormously, both in terms of dollars and in loss coverage for its citizens.
So next up, we have the budget fight in Washington, and a lot of this will continue, but maybe even stepping back in our final minute or so, do you have a, now that you're coming to the end of your professional career at the United Hospital Fund, do you have any kind of prognosis about what we're looking at for healthcare either nationally and or here in New York? And finally, at some point, getting to a true universal coverage program, be it a mixture of patchwork programs or a streamlined program, or any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that is the debate that moves forward, and I think that it is important to note at this point that we have just come through an historic battle, and as we are awaiting the Congress to return after Labor Day, the Democrats have been successful, along with some selected Republican legislators who stood up at the right point in time, in not passing the repeal, so-called repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act. President Trump said everyone was going to have coverage and it was going to be low insurance premiums. And, of course, that isn't what has come out of the Congress. That isn't what the Congressional Budget Office has said. For starters, this is taking away coverage from 20 million people, and that's just the starting point. As I point, and I point out, the big issue in the Republican proposal is this long-term cut in Medicaid that ultimately, by 2035, reduces Medicaid expenditures in the federal government by more than 33%. That is a huge structural change. I think that when we go back, we'll see if the fight continues, or if the Congress moves on. There's some effort at bipartisan efforts to work together on the Affordable Care Act. I think that people concerned with getting to universal coverage would be wise to give careful consideration to continuing to build on the Affordable Care Act. I know that there's a great interest in moving to a single-payer plan, but a single-payer plan really raises two important questions. First, would 160 million Americans who receive their coverage through their employers, do they really want to lose that coverage in favor of a Medicare program? And then the even bigger question, what kind of Medicare program are we talking about? Speaker Ryan sort of showed his hand in this. He has always been an advocate of reducing Medicaid expenditures, reducing Medicare expenditures, and reducing Social Security and restructuring those programs going forward into the future. That is an important philosophical position that has been taken by a number of people on the right. We've already seen evidence of what it means in Medicaid. It means huge changes in Medicaid. And so the question I would ask all my friends who talk about Medicare for All is, what Medicare program are you talking about? The one that we've have, the one that we have now, or the one that Speaker Ryan and his colleagues may want to give us in the future? For me, it's a matter of caution. I would continue to work with and build on the Affordable Care program, on the Affordable Care Act, if we get that opportunity coming out of this congressional battle, which so far by the narrowest of margins has been won by a unified Democratic Party.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Jim. This has been a wonderful little tutorial for all of us, myself included. I've been on the scene a while, but I learned some things, so thank you very much. We've been taking a look in this interview segment about the history of healthcare in New York State since the beginning of the Medicare and Medicaid program. Our special guest has been Jim Tallon, former president and CEO of the United Hospital Fund and a former state member of the State Assembly prior to that. Thanks so much for joining us on Health Action, Jim.
Mark, thank you, and congratulations on all the good work you've done over the years.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And that'll do it for Health Action for this week. We'll be back next week. Catherine Davis and Bob Letter will be bringing you some information and interview segments. I'm Mark Hannay. Thanks to Reggie Johnson for engineering this week's program.
Hi, this is Randy Credico, host of Randy Credico Live on the Fly here on WBAI Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Hey, did you know you can actually donate to WBAI via text message? That's right, for as little as $10. Just text the letters WBAI to the number 41444. Keep the vision of Lewis Hill alive. Join the WBAI $10 text team. Text WBAI to the number 41444. That's all, folks.
When we look back under the Orange Man's years, we're going to see a lot of bad things, and people are going to be very disappointed.
Brooklyn Councilmember Jemani Williams.
One of the things that we're going to look back, and not the least of which, is what happened with the press under this time. Anytime you have fascism, anytime you have dictatorial leadership, the press is always attacked. And we've seen the press attacked over and over and over again. But we have to have places where the public can not only feel comfortable going, but feel that they have a part and a stake in the news that is put out. And there was none other bigger in New York City than WBAI.
Listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI. Become a member. Phone 516-620-3602 and make a pledge. Or go to your smartphone and enter 41444 and text WBAI.
Too public to fail! Too public to fail! Too public to fail!
And good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, believe it or not, for the first time in, 6 or 7 weeks. My name is Jim Freund. That has remained the same. And this is a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor. This morning, to catch up from the time lost when I was at ReaderCon, thank you, Lister, for filling in, and the 4 out of 4 preemptions that I had for the thon, we have 2 movie reviews from Dan Persons of stuff that opened recently, and then we will have Carlos Hernandez and Claire Cooney from the most recent New York Review of Science Fiction reading. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. There are 2 scenes missing from the beginning of Spider-Man Homecoming. I understand the reason why both aren't there, and I'll explain that in a sec, but they are still conspicuous by their absence. One of the truly great things about the Sam Raimi Spider-Mans, yes, even Spider-Man 3, were the lengths the director went through to establish empathy for the bad guys. You may not like the men who became the Green Goblin or Doc Ock or Sandman. You may not approve of what they did, but you understood them. And more importantly, you understood that the stakes for them were deeper than just a vague desire to rule the world or become insanely rich. At the opening flashback of Spider-Man Homecoming, we meet Adrian Toomes, a small business owner of a demolition company who, in the aftermath of the destruction that capped the first Avengers film, gets kicked off his cleanup gig by a joint government-slash-Tony Stark operation, nice little one-percenter dig there, and begins a life of crime with the help of his crew and some purloined alien technology. An ellipsis takes us to present day, when Toomes has become classic Spider-Man villain Vulture, and has leveraged his operation into a profitable purveyor of hand-tooled instruments of awesome destruction. As I mentioned, there are 2 things that dug at me about how this backstory was handled. The one that I can talk about is that we don't really get to see the progression of Toomes going from small business owner to supervillain. He just suddenly is. I understand the reason for this. The film is already over 2 hours long. I actually salute the realization that something needed to be reined in. The other problem I can't really talk about because it concerns a major plot spoiler, but it's the more important one because it concerns Toomes' stake in why he's doing what he does, his motivations. Here again, the reason why this scene is omitted is because it would wreck a reveal later in the film. But I wonder whether the value of that surprise, which is pretty good, admittedly, was worth us not getting a better understanding of what makes Toomes tick. As it stands, the film has to settle for Toomes repeatedly stating his motivation straight out, bumping into the whole don't-tell-show dilemma, and rely upon Michael Keaton's nicely nuanced performance of a blue-collar businessman made good. These aren't damning criticisms. Spider-Man Homecoming is overall a heartening return back to what made the Spider-Man franchise so fun to begin with. That title, Spider-Man Homecoming, could only be more pointed if the film had actually been called Spider-Man, look, we know we screwed up with the last couple of films, so here, look, he's back in high school and kinda nerdy out of his costume and cocky and clever when he's doing his superhero stuff, just like you want it, right? Director John Watts shows more investment in the character than his predecessor and achieves the not inconsiderable task of keeping the high school stakes on a near equal footing with all the superhero stuff. Tom Holland hits the right notes in his Peter Parker, a little awkward, a little overconfident, a little too eager to give up his grounded civilian life and join mentor Tony Stark. Yeah, Robert Downey Jr. and a fair portion of the Iron Man cast is here too, in his world-spanning Avenger exploits. There's a truly great sequence when some rampant vulture tech splits a Staten Island ferry in half, and I'm grateful for the relatively scaled-down finale that brings it back to the two adversaries, rather than focusing on yet another world-threatening widget. There's been a lot of jubilation of late with recent superhero films refinding their footing, but let's not go overboard. Spider-Man Homecoming is really good. The story and characters managed to justify the 2.25-hour running time, and I'm looking forward to going back to school with our friendly neighborhood web-slinger the next time around. Up until a few days ago, what I mostly knew about Dario Argento's 1970 film The Bird with the Crystal Plumage, which recently was re-released on Blu-ray, was that the TV ads touted it as being in the Hitchcock tradition. Turns out the ad guys weren't kidding. Near the beginning of the film, the hero, a down-and-out writer played by Tony Musante, witnesses a woman being assaulted by a mysterious killer through the giant windows of a stark white modern art gallery. When he rushes to the window to help, the killer closes another pane of glass behind him, trapping him in a transparent sandwich where on one side he's forced to watch the woman bleed out, and on the other he fruitlessly begs passers-by for help. It's a modernist rewrite of Rear Window, and the indictment of the audience for their voyeuristic impulses is only emphasized by proportioning the window to match the format of the movie screen. It's one visually arresting moment in a film full of them. Not surprising, since the great Vittorio Storaro was cinematographer here. Argento has lots of lurid fun with his quest for a serial killer, including introducing us to a pimp with a stutter, an artist with disturbing culinary tastes, and a snitch who would have been right at home in the Nixon White House. I'm not that well-schooled in giallo, the Italian genre of violent, intense crime thrillers. I don't suppose they could all be as avidly unhinged as The Bird with the Crystal Plumage. I'm just glad this one is. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons. Hashtag ITMFA. I'm Dan.
I couldn't resist. I just had to do it. I'm sure Dan goes along with me. By the way, if and when you do go see Spider-Man, stay through the credits. I promise you, it's worth it at the very end. It is the second best post-credit Marvel event ever. By the way, I'm trying something weird. I'm doing a Facebook Live. I've never done this before. I have a brand new phone. I hardly know how to use the technology on it. It's what they call a Pixel XL. Yeah, I know there's a new one coming out, but I had the ability to get it now. And so I did. So if you happen, oh my God, people, yes, I'm sideways. Oh, so, well, you see, I've got, yeah, I'm not sideways on my phone. Thank you for telling me. You see, the cool thing about Facebook Live is that this phone, rather. Okay, is that better, folks? Yeah, you see, I've actually got a little stand there, and that stand won't go the whole way. It's made for a camera, not for a phone. So now I guess I'm there. Thank you, Carol. Oh my God, why is all the text behind me in reversed? Yes, thank you, Teal. I think you're unbalanced in any case. Well, this is sort of cool. It's like phone calls because people can yell at me, and they certainly are. Okay, we have another review, and I have a feeling I haven't listened to it yet. I have a feeling that I am going to have most definite comments to Dan after we hear this review together. Let's tune in.
Hour of the Wolf. The full title of the film is Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, and it appears director Luc Besson is determined to make good on that promise. Over the course of the film, which visits several planets before centering in on the unimaginably immense space station whose individual biospheres compose the titular Thousand Planet City, we meet just about every kind of alien species available: aquatic creatures, creatures devoted to lives of pure knowledge, alive, beautiful species whose moods are displayed in changing